This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two suicide bombing missions in Jerusalem this summer, one in a market, the other in a pedestrian mall, killed 18 people and dealt a blow to the peace process. An offshoot of Hamas called Martyrs for Freeing Prisoners claimed responsibility for both attacks. My two guests have studied how Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement, recruits young men to become martyrs for the cause. Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg are visiting scholars at Harvard's Center for Middle East Studies. They've spent 6 years in Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. They've collected the Hamas songs, slogans, underground videos, and martyr cards, which inspire young men to join suicide squadrons and look forward to death. Oliver and Steinberg are writing a book to be published by Oxford University Press. It focuses on an action in which three bombers were supposed to blow up an Israeli bus, but the mission failed. Oliver and Steinberg were able to interview the surviving bomber. I asked Oliver to profile the type of young men recruited for suicide missions.
Well, there are a number of characteristics they share. Usually they're youngish, in their 20s, sometimes in their early 30s, sometimes younger. Generally unmarried, and I think this is an important factor to emphasize, their unmarried and childless state. Generally in Palestinian society, there's a uncomfortably prolonged adolescence, and there are usually many males in the family, and each one must be married, and there is a very high dowry that must be paid to the potential wife. They generally exist on the margins of Palestinian society. The major focus of our book is a young man named Hamza Abu Sarur, who I suppose we chose him because of his ambivalence in the last will and testament, which he records before he goes out to kill himself, as well as other people. He appears, he's smiling, he is ecstatic about his upcoming death. And when you look into the history of Abu Sarur, you see that he was a highly ambivalent boy. He actually trained as a hairdresser in Israel and worked in Israel, and was probably a collaborator for the Israeli military authority in the West Bank before he converted to Hamas.
Paul, what was the mission that Hamza Abu Sarur was assigned?
Well, ostensibly, Hamza and two of his companions were to take over an Israeli bus in downtown Jerusalem and demand the release of a number of high-profile Hamas prisoners, including the head of the movement, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who has been in prison for a number of years in Israel. The action, though, was destined, in a sense, to fail, if you want to call it that. They knew the demands would be rejected, and they were carrying, each of them, bags of high explosives, and they were prepared to blow up the bus when their demands were not met. In that sense, it differed from some of the later suicide bombings, in which there was no demands made at all, and in fact, no one on the bus realized there was anything happening until the bus exploded. This change perhaps came about because Hamza's and his companions' mission was a failure of sorts, because they didn't indeed blow up their bombs.
Would you describe a little bit of what you know of how the mission took place, how it was staged, what they did to get on the bus and not be noticed?
The mission was elaborate in its staging. Just as in the latest suicide bombings in downtown Jerusalem, a number of the assailants were dressed as women, so too were the three young men. All each had their individual disguise. Hamza Abu Sarur, the young man who is featured so prominently in the video we're studying, was dressed as an Israeli soldier. Not just as an Israeli soldier, he was said he was going to be dressed as a Russian soldier returning from leave, carrying his bag of possessions. The young man who actually survived the attack and who we later interviewed was dressed as a businessman carrying a briefcase loaded with explosives, of course. And the third young man who sat in the back of the bus was dressed as a student wearing blue jeans, had his hair cut in a special fashion so he would look like a young Israeli college student. They all boarded the bus at different stops. They didn't speak to each other. They sat at different points of the bus. At the moment, with the predetermined moment, Hamza Abu Sarur stood up, intending to take control of the bus. He raised his gun in the air. He shot the gun, and he said, "This is a kidnapping." All of a sudden, all hell broke loose on the bus. Israelis had been the victim of numerous suicide bombings before. In some terrible way, everybody's primed for this moment. Their worst fears are realized. But instead of reacting passively, the people on the bus tried to wrestle these three young men to the ground and to save themselves. In the confusion, shots were fired. The surviving suicide bomber was felled with a bullet that passed clean through his head. Nobody expected him to live past that moment, of course, which he did. The other two young men, for some reason, which is unclear since they were later killed, left the bus. Instead of they could have blown the bus up, they didn't. They left the bus. They tried to escape. They kidnapped a woman on the street. They forced her into a car. They drove off. They were later shot and killed at an Israeli roadblock on the road back to the West Bank, tragically with the woman they had kidnapped. The final denouement of the action is shrouded in all sorts of unknowns, exactly what took place.
And they weren't treated as cowards by Hamas for the two who fled instead of blowing up the bus?
When we interviewed the survivor, we were accompanied by a Gazan who could help us, you know, get access. He was very suspicious. He kept peppering this young man who survived with questions. Well, why didn't you explode the bus? Why didn't you explode the bus? He obviously did not believe the story that the man tried, the explosive failed, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, in an odd and sort of eerie moment, the young man's father, who was sitting in the same room, came to the defense of his son and said, he tried. He tried to kill himself. He tried to kill everybody on the bus. Officially, the action is treated as a success. Officially, most people on the bus were killed. The statement that was released said that everybody on the bus was killed. In fact, they were not.
Did everyone survive except for the bombers?
One woman died. The driver, I believe, was seriously injured. And of course, the woman who they kidnapped died too.
You interviewed the survivor. Of the three, was he repentant or really glad that he had participated in this? Had he changed politically? And let me say that he was saved by an Israeli doctor after he was shot, and he was shot accidentally by one of his own comrades.
Probably, what actually transpired on the bus is hard to say.
I see. Too much chaos.
We think
to
he
know.
Was shot mm-hmm. by his own companion. But yeah, he was ironically saved by an Israeli doctor. He was taken to Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, a very well-known hospital. And when he came to from his wound, he told us he had lost the ability to speak. The only words that came out of his mouth were, Allahu Akbar, God is great, God is great. He was finally put back together to a degree, although he's seriously wounded. And will be and seriously crippled for the rest of his life. But he's not repentant in the least. He, in some ways, truly lives out the script of the suicide bomber. He is forever a living martyr. He's as we said, he's crippled. He has terrible speech impediments. He can't walk. He can't move at all very well. So he lies in his bed surrounded by his friends and family, and he's revered. He's revered as not only a warrior, but as a living saint. But at the same time, he gets to enjoy some of the fruits of his victory, which is, one would think, denied to most of his companions. He's married. His wife is pregnant. He's going to have children. He's looking forward to that.
Was he ever arrested by the Israeli Defense Forces? I mean, he was treated by an Israeli doctor, and that's how he survived. How come he's free?
He was released from prison, and the reasons are unbeknownst to us.
He was expected to die. Perhaps he was released because they didn't want another martyr, somebody who died in prison. The reasons are unclear. A lot of people on the Israeli side express chagrin that he was released.
My guests are Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg, and they're both visiting scholars at the Center for Middle East Studies at Harvard University. They're the author of a forthcoming book on the suicide bombers of Hamas. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anne-Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg, visiting scholars at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University and co-authors of a forthcoming book on the suicide bombers of Hamas, scheduled to be published by Oxford University Press. I'd like to talk with you about how martyrdom becomes such a kind of exalted experience for these young men. And in your writing, you make it seem like part of the attraction is that they're made into heroes before they even die. And part of the way that they're made into heroes is through videos that they make of themselves posing with their guns, posing with their bombs and grenades. Would you describe one of the videos that you've seen, perhaps, from this group of suicide bombers?
Well, the video which we're focusing on, which is the last words of Hamza Abu Sarur and his comrades, who constitute Force 3 of the battalions of Izzeddin al-Qassam, starts out with Hamza Abu Sarur being interviewed by his trainer, and he's ecstatically happy, and he talks about meeting the Prophet Muhammad and his companions, and also friends of his who were martyred before him. And the videotape is structured in terms of interviewing all three of the martyrs-to-be. There's also an interview with the trainer, Abu Aziz, in which he tells his trainees and the spectator of the video that there are all kinds of ways to die. You can fall off a donkey and die. You can fall off the roof of your house and die. You can die in a hospital bed and so forth. But truly, there's a huge difference between one death and another. And there's only, then he quotes the martyr, Abdullah Azam, there is only one death, so let it be on the path of God. Then what follows in this videotape is a display of weapons. And it's a fairly typical structuring of these videotapes.
And who's supposed to see it? What's the purpose?
The purpose is for the tape to be, number one, a recruitment device for young men who would like to follow in the footsteps of Abu Sarur and his comrades. And second, a general advertisement for Hamas.
During the whole of the Intifada, there was tremendous interfactional rivalry between Hamas and Fatah, between the different groups within the PLO over who were the true agents of the Intifada, who were the ones who were really fighting Israel. And early on, there was this competition through media. There was competition through graffiti. There was competition through posters. And there was finally competition through these videotapes. In a sense, Hamas probably won the competition in that they were the most adept at producing innovative, interesting media. We noticed it very early on in our work that Hamas sort of set the standard, and the other groups would try to play catch-up. Hamas developed this whole very ritualized cycle of media. It's sort of important to realize that the video was only one aspect of this whole cycle of media which surrounded the person of the martyr.
What else is there?
Well, typically speaking, when he was a fugitive, before he had actually done his suicide operation, there were photos taken of him. There was these videotapes recorded of him. These were then stored, and after his successful, in quotation marks, operation, the photos would be distributed throughout the West Bank. The video would be released. Often poems and songs were composed in his honor, which were sung and distributed widely throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Perhaps a subunit within one of the Hamas bands would be named after him. Giant posters would be constructed of him and put all over the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. His family would be given places of honor at giant celebrations. And he, the young man who was ready to set out on the suicide operation, had seen many, perhaps dozens of these celebrations, of these videos before. He knew he was going to get his great moment of fame. This is one of the key motivating factors for the recruitment of the young boys.
So it's almost the equivalent of being like a homemade Hollywood star if you're willing to give your life for it. You become a star after your death.
Yeah, I mean, acquiring a great name is definitely a motivating factor in for suicide bombers, the suicide bombers of Hamas.
The martyrs are aiming for what is described as death on the path of God. They're told that they'll go to paradise and their victims will go to hell. What image of paradise are they given by Hamas?
The most attractive aspect of paradise is the fact that there are perpetually virginal maidens awaiting the martyr there, usually said to number 70. There are rivers of milk and honey, trees which provide shade. They're very literal renditions of paradise. And what's remarkable about the testimonies of the young men whom we study is the very literal rendering of paradise. In fact, Abu Sarur and his comrades supposedly spent their last night together discussing these perpetually virginal maidens, who would get how many, they would share them amongst themselves in such and such fashion and so on.
My understanding from your writing is that the suicide bombers are told that in paradise, beautiful young virgins await them. But while they're alive and being trained for martyrdom, they're not allowed to have sex, and they're not allowed to be employed either. I don't know what the connection is between the two of them, but those are two things they're prohibited from.
I think ecstasy in any culture is a precious commodity, and one of the primary means by which authorities attempt to bolster themselves and their power is by controlling and channeling ecstasy. And we see that very clearly in the media of Hamas. I mean, what's prohibited is as important as what's talked about as the thing to do, what's prescribed. And what's prohibited is pleasure, whether it be in the form of picnics or sexuality or music and dancing or what have you. All of this pleasure is deferred until paradise.
What's interesting is that during this period when the young men are known to the authorities, but before their actual death, they are called living martyrs. They, in a sense, are already dead. They have a foot in paradise already. And during this time, as we talked about a little earlier, they feel this tremendous sense of excitement and exaltation. Every moment seems to them magical. It's all very, very adolescent. None of the discourse is carried out at a very sophisticated level. It's all the kind of rhetoric that appeals both to the would-be suiciders and also to their the most important audience, which is the other young men watching the tapes. And in fact, the people who make the tapes know the power of the tapes they're making. And almost every tape, without exception, and we've seen dozens of them, there's a moment where the suicider talks straight out to his audience and he says, "Just because we're doing this doesn't mean you should rush out. You, the viewer, should rush out and follow in our footsteps precipitously. These kind of actions need to be done properly," because they realize how very compelling the image they're presenting is to these other young, adolescent, post-adolescent young men living in desperate situations. How very compelling that this image is.
You said that the Hamas suicide bombers have to rehearse and choreograph their own death. How do they do that?
Well, one of our major arguments is that the media, the underground media of Hamas, function in just this respect as a means by which these youth could rehearse their deaths and prepare for it. In fact, begin to think of themselves as dead objects. And once you begin to think of yourself as a dead object, then the route to your actual death is quite short.
What's interesting, and something we didn't expect at first, was that many of the young men who are enlisted and trained for these actions are not taken from the population that we had first expected. We thought we would find very motivated, very religious, very fanatical types, but by and large, they really weren't. They were, as Anne-Marie said, very marginalized young men, and the whole process bore a striking similarity to the cults that we see in our own country, where they take these people from the margin society, generally speaking from very poor families, and they're brought into this movement where they're given love and acceptance. They're elevated very rapidly to positions of respect and near sainthood within their own society.
You compare the Hamas suicide bombers with people who join cults. When you join Hamas, are you given a new name, a new identity, something to kind of separate you from the people who love you and don't want you to die?
Yes, almost all the young men take on nom de guerre. Hamza Abu Sarur's nom de guerre was Father of the Martyr. And you take on a new name, you take on a new identity.
It's also important, though, just jump in here. When you speak of Hamas, we're speaking very loosely here. The young men we're studying and the book we're writing is about the suicide squadrons of Hamas. And Hamas is actually a large movement, which is basically the main opposition political party in Palestine. It embraces many different strands, a lot of them not connected with suicide bombing whatsoever. So when you join Hamas, you don't necessarily take a nom de guerre. You don't necessarily become a suicide bomber. The theology and the political ideology which is brought forth to justify the killing is not normative in any sense of the word. It's very specialized for not just for Hamas, but even in particular for the suicide squadrons of Hamas. And it postulates a very dualistic, Manichaean kind of world system where there's the forces of unbelief who are at war with the forces of belief. And those who are within the camp of the forces of unbelief by birth, by avocation, are legitimate targets just by their very existence. In fact, it's interesting that many of these suicide actions or many of the more spectacular actions were not accompanied by any demands at all. There's no demands made upon their enemy. It's not meant to affect policy change in, as much as it is meant to be a spectacular action witnessing the struggle of the sons of light, if you like, against the sons of darkness.
Paul Steinberg and Anne-Marie Oliver are visiting scholars at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies. They're writing a book on the suicide squadrons of Hamas to be published by Oxford University Press. They'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more on the suicide bombers of Hamas. My guests, Paul Steinberg and Anne-Marie Oliver, are visiting scholars at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies. They're writing a book on the suicide squadrons of Hamas and the underground media that Hamas uses to recruit young men and create martyrs for the cause. Oliver and Steinberg spent 6 years in Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. How are the suicide bombings justified by Islam, by the people who train the bombers? Is the Quran brought in to justify this? Is Islam brought in to?
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. Just as with the with Jewish terrorists, they would bring in scripture, and Christian terrorists would also bring in scripture. Scripture is wonderful in the sense that it can be used for many purposes, but there's nothing within Islam, of course, per se, which justifies these actions.
Who decides when a young martyr in training is ready to actually go out and do the job?
Typically, there's one person, maybe two people, who are responsible for the young men. These are the people with a little more authority within Hamas, generally very different types, by the way, than the young martyrs-to-be. Where the young martyrs-to-be or the suicide bombers, as we mentioned, are drawn from the outside society. They tend to be sort of lost types. The trainers are more the natural leaders, those who are always respected within their community, those who look forward to a life just beyond the Intifada, perhaps.
A lot of your study is based not just on the interview you did with the surviving suicide bomber, but also with underground literature and videos that you've collected. How did you get access to that?
Well, we lived in Gaza for 6 months at the beginning of the Intifada, and while there, started noticing the graffiti on the walls, which were these incredible cryptograms to us at the time. The walls were like palimpsests, you know. Messages would come up one day and then they'd be gone the next. So we began to record these messages and actually collect any kind of street media we could get a hold of. As the Intifada evolved, of course, the media became more sophisticated and we collected everything that came off the street and now have a collection of, large collection of underground media, including photographs of graffiti, audio cassettes, videotapes, martyr cards, plaques in which you place a photo of your beloved dead who's now a martyr, and the whole thing set. You simply put in the photograph of your family member, and then you have a martyr plaque that you can hang in your home. We collected everything that we could, and oftentimes had to smuggle them out of Gaza, either under the IDF or under the PA.
Yeah, both. To both the Israelis and to the PLO, Hamas is an enemy. Hamas is an opposition movement, if you want to call it that. It's a profoundly subversive movement. In some ways, it was more difficult collecting under the Palestinians than it was under the Israelis.
You lived in Gaza for about 6 months. How much popular support do the suicide bombings have there?
Well, it depends on the moment when you ask the question, what's going on in the political arena at that time. I mean, the hardcore of Hamas is very small, actually. Even the membership as a whole is probably estimated at about 15%. But yes, there is popular sympathy on the street for Hamas and for its suicide bombers in particular, as realizers of these old heroic scripts, which we talked about before. It's difficult to say, you know, to give a percentage to that support, but it's definitely there. There's a great deal of pride taken in these guys.
And as one would guess, the more desperate the situation becomes, the more these actions are seen as justifiable. It's not uncommon at all to talk to people who say, we abhor these actions, we abhor the taking of innocent life, but, and the but encompasses everything. The but encompasses the misery of their daily existence. The but encompasses the oppression they feel both under the Israelis and now under the PLO. The but encompasses the hopelessness they see.
Let me ask you about the impact of studying how the suicide bombers prepare to do their work. Do you now feel like you really comprehend how and why somebody would do this, or are you more mystified than you were when you started?
Yeah, I think both. Yes, you understand more, and the more you understand, the less you understand. I think the conditions under which both Palestinians and Israelis live is absolutely intolerable. The level of anxiety and fear is so great that people find it very difficult to simply live. There's this constant primal anxiety in the air. And that's before I talked about sacrifice and martyrdom as preemptive strikes. And I think that's what they are, or what one scholar has actually called deferential self-injury. There's the threat of death constantly in the air, great anxiety about one's well-being, one's security. And suicide bombers are the most spectacular rendering of this fact, of getting it over with and trying to attain some kind of mastery over the inevitable.
Suicide is also contagious. Suicide, especially among the young, breeds other suicide. And without wanting to sound too alarmist, it should be kept in mind that the contagion will not necessarily be limited to the Palestinians alone. The conditions exist within certain sectors of Israeli society too for other kinds of actions. Probably not exactly the same, but there already have been a number of attacks which were suicide attacks. So one can think of Baruch Goldstein in Hebron, who entered the mosque there and opened fire, knowing that when his bullets ran out, he would die. One thinks of the assassin Yigal Amir, who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin in broad view of crowds of people, knowing that he too, chances are, would not survive the bullets of Rabin's bodyguards. He did, of course, survive. This kind of hysteria is hard. It's hard to limit.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about your study of the suicide bombers from Hamas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Anne Marie Oliver and Paul Steinberg are visiting scholars at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies. They're writing a book on the suicide squadrons of Hamas to be published by Oxford University Press.